In Europe especially, this winter may feel longer, colder and darker than usual. Such optimism as flourished about halting the progress of COVID-19 during the summer has receded. As lockdowns and other measures eased, the virus regathered momentum. Cases of COVID-19 are rising, in some places exceeding the numbers of the earliest weeks of the pandemic, and restrictions are once again descending. As of Friday, more than 46 million French people in 38 cities and regions are living under an overnight curfew. Lockdowns have returned to Slovakia, the Czech Republic and Ireland, among others. Here in the United Kingdom, we live beneath a three-tier regime of limitations, which might feel even more of an imposition if anybody understood any of them. All that being the case, grounds for optimism may seem difficult to spot. But while we may not have a solution, we should by now have a better understanding of the problem, and hopefully some sharper ideas about means of containing COVID-19 which don't result in ailments worse than those associated with the virus itself. Are there any lessons which can be usefully exported from the world's apparent success stories? How can public health messaging adapt when people become more bored and annoyed than fearful and careful? Most crucially of all, how are we doing with a vaccine? This is the Foreign Desk.
Vietnam has been able to set up the contact tracing system very quickly. Even in early January, when news about that strain disease come out from China, the government already have a lot of preparation for it. I think it's because of the lesson learned from SARS, so Vietnam has the same reaction.
What was missed in the summer was the opportunity to really develop that way of living to prevent this resurgence now. Let's hope that people have got the message now and we get through this winter learning this new dance and finding a way to live as well as we can and as safely as we can.
There will be a vaccine. People are optimistic in that respect. They think we're going to get one. They think that actually we're going to see results from phase 3 trials for many of the vaccine candidates that have made it that far. Pretty soon. When is that going to reach the general population? The argument goes it's something like next year.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. We'll start with a perhaps counterintuitive success story. If any country on earth appeared ripe for ravage by COVID-19, it was Vietnam, a developing nation of 95 million people, about 15 million of whom live in two huge, densely packed cities, sharing 1,300 kilometres of land border with China, epicentre of the outbreak. As of this broadcast, the World Health Organization reports 1,148 confirmed cases in Vietnam since February, and just 35 deaths, about the same number in 9 months that die every day on Vietnam's roads. Well, joining me from Hanoi to explain how Vietnam was able to do this is the journalist Tran Le Thuy. First of all, those figures, they are from the World Health Organization, but the WHO are relying on Vietnamese official numbers. How solid are they?
I think they are trustworthy because the government have been updating every day to the people. And also, I think independent sources like Reuters, they try to check the number in several ways. They, Reuters News, they call on the hospital in Vietnam to check the number of deaths. They found out that the number of deaths actually decreased because of decreased number of traffic accidents.
I mean, if we look at the response to the pandemic in itself, is there a simple way to explain, especially to listeners in countries which are very much struggling, is there a simple way to explain how Vietnam has done this?
The strategy of Vietnam is very simple and straightforward, actually. First, they consider it's a very serious pandemic, and they cut out completely on the route of the transmission of the disease. I mean, on the people who infected would be hospitalized and isolated. And they use, in the hospital, they use all the equipment possible to prevent transmission of the disease. And they also do contact tracing to 4-layer. And also, like, the people are very, they follow the government's advice. They wear masks. So it's very simple, but it's effective.
So how quickly was Vietnam able to set up a contact tracing system, and how important has that been?
Vietnam have been able to set up the contact tracing system very quickly. I think they were very well prepared. Even in early January, when news about that strain disease come out from China, the government already have a lot of preparation for it. They already checked hospital capacity. They set up a committee head by the vice prime minister and minister in charge to enable to have action as quickly as possible. I think it's because of the lesson learned from SARS. So Vietnam has the same reaction. The contact tracing is similar to SARS when it happened in Vietnam.
You were talking earlier about the public trust in the government message as relayed via the Vietnamese media. That seems a little bit counterintuitive because, you know, as you will know, Vietnam is consistently ranked as having one of the least free media environments in the world. I think in the last World Press Freedom Index, it ranked 175th out of 180. Has that relationship between government and media changed at all during this crisis?
Actually, Vietnamese media is more sophisticated, in my opinion, compared to the Press Freedom Index. From my observation and experience, I see that the Vietnamese media, they actually can be free to a certain level. For example, during SARS, they were completely free to report about SARS. And during COVID-19, they're also free. As long as they practice good journalism, you know, check the source and have evidence. And it's fact-based, then they are able to publish. And they're also able to do investigation, you know, up to quite high level, ministerial level. The Vietnamese media, mainstream media, state-owned media, they're still able to publish story, investigation like that. So I don't see that the relationship with the government and the media have changed a lot during COVID. It is the same, you know, because the practice already before, it's just more prominent for people to see it.
Because what I'm trying to figure out, I guess, is how important a cohesive communal national response has been in dealing with this. Because as you would know, here in Britain, in the United States, all across Europe and the democratic world, there is a huge political argument about the best way to deal with this pandemic. In Vietnam, has there been any kind of resistance to the strictures, any kind of criticism of the government, or is everybody basically in agreement about the way forward?
I haven't heard a lot of resistance. For example, I don't hear a lot of people protest against masks at all. People just wear masks because they trust. They think it's common sense that masks is safe for them. I think the people quite agree with the government. Actually, Vietnamese people are quite educated and quite well informed about the pandemic. I think they understand the government strategy. Also, because the strategy of the government is quite, it treated a public health crisis, and we don't see a lot of sort of like politicized or religious or any commercial interests that entangle with the government strategy much, at least until now. So I think the public trust has increased a lot on the government due to the strategy. Before the pandemic, I often hear people complains about government. You know, if you go on a grab car, I often chat to grab car driver. They complain about government. It rarely hear compliment from the normal people about the Vietnamese government. But during the COVID-19 and with the government strategy, we hear that they trust the government a lot, and at least on the COVID-19 strategy.
Tran Le Thuy in Hanoi, thank you for joining us. Vietnam's apparent success in tackling COVID-19 is remarkable, regrettably, because of its rarity. Well, joining me now to discuss where the rest of the world is at are Dr. Margaret Harris and Dr. Chris Smith. Margaret Harris is a spokesperson for the World Health Organization, and Chris Smith is Monocle 24's health and science correspondent and a virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, at the top of the show, we did hear a description from Vietnam of how well they appear to have done in tackling this thing. The description of Vietnam right now will have inspired, I think, an amount of wistful longing in a great many listeners who aren't in Vietnam. So if we start with a big question, which is there a way we can get, say, here in Europe from where we are now to where Vietnam is?
really tricky. I'm sorry to say, we've just been hearing this week from Jason Leach, who is the medical lead in Scotland. And he advised people across Scotland this week to prepare for a digital Christmas. And if that's not managing expectations, I don't know what is. I mean, I suppose being gathered around your laptop isn't really what most people have as their idea of festive fun, although it may translate into fewer arguments. But the reason he's saying that is that the level of virus that's circulating across the country in the UK, but also across many European countries, is extremely high. And as a result of that, various manoeuvres and measures that are anything short of a lockdown will take a very long time to bring that under control again. So we're going to see appreciably big numbers for quite a while yet, and therefore more draconian measures are going to be necessary to get those numbers down. Once you've got the level of virus in the community down to very low levels, it becomes amenable to other measures. And those include things like tracking and tracing, because tracking and tracing is very effective when the levels of virus are quite low and you can go in and surgically intervene in the population and find the people and isolate them. But when you're trying to isolate almost an entire country, you can see it logically is not going to work.
Margaret, the reason we decided to do this show this week was because we looked at the tales of reports of foreboding coming out of Europe in particular, and decided to try and think about what we have actually learnt about this virus in the time that we've been trying to deal with it. So if we think back to the beginning of this year, around February, March, when it first began to take hold in Europe in particular, is there anything that we have learned in the 7 or 8 months since then that would have made a difference if we'd applied it at the time?
Well, I think exactly what Chris has just said is one of the secrets. Getting the numbers down, when you've got them down to levels where you can follow where the virus is, where you can then surgically remove it by using quarantine, isolation, old-fashioned things, but also genuine isolation. So if I say to you, you need to isolate for 14 days, I make sure you do it. And I make sure you don't come into contact with other people. If you can do that, it works particularly well when you've got lower numbers. It gets much harder when your numbers rise, because it's just so much harder to find all the people, because you've just got chains of transmission all over the place. The other thing we've learned about this virus is it likes to propagate itself through clusters. It's an interesting sort of transmission. We have these events where one person may have infected a large number of people, and then when you go back and look, some people don't infect anyone. So again, this is why we talk very much about limiting opportunities for that sort of event, like not having people in very crowded small spaces where the ventilation is poor, especially if you're, say, yelling over loud music or something, that when you're in those sorts of circumstances, you've got a high chance of one of these large sort of cluster events happening.
Chris, is the jury yet definitely in on whether the headline measures that we have seen, like lockdowns in particular, more or less universal mask wearing, do they actually work? Do we know for sure yet?
Well, we've got a whole country level sets of data, not just in one country, but across, you know, a lot of countries that strongly argue that these sorts of measures work very well. And it's obvious why they work, because if you confine people to barracks, you are breaking the chain of transmission. You are not affording the virus the opportunity to transmit between individuals, which is what it thrives on. That's certainly true. But the problem is one has to balance that against the cost, the stupendous cost of doing this. We estimate that the UK has so far spent £350 billion getting to the point it's at, which arguably is not a very enviable one, because we're still in a situation where we're verging on retreating to that position again. We have perhaps 50,000 cases per day of virus going through the community at the moment, and we have no end in sight because there is no vaccine, and it's a risk of perpetual cycles of lockdowns and sort of de-repression afterwards, and then a surge and another lockdown. So at the moment, we're not really in an enviable position through having had a lockdown. But if you look at the lockdown itself, it did work. It does work. It's very effective because it breaks chains of transmission. But this is not, and Margaret will echo this probably, the World Health Organization have said to countries, please don't do lockdowns and don't use this as a blunt instrument because of the collateral damage that this does. when you rob a country of its riches, you don't just rob a country financially, you rob it educationally, you also rob it psychologically. And this sort of pillaging has long-term legacy effects, and you're in danger, if you're not careful, of actually ending up with a pill that's worse than the ill, which is why we have to learn to live with this virus, adapt our lifestyles, and come up with ways that do work, ways that can control it, and ways that will do that, but without or with minimal impact on our standard of living and people's livelihoods and people's ability to actually remain happy. Because the problem we're going to be facing as we go through winter, which is always a sad time for many, many people, lots of people get winter blues, we're going to start to see lots of people getting very, very unhappy. And if those people then end up in such a dark place that they feel compelled to kill themselves, which is already happening, then we'll end up with a situation where the death toll because of COVID begins to be greater than the death toll from COVID.
Margaret, here in the UK, certainly, and I think it was also the case across much of Europe and in the United States, we saw what I think was an attempt by governments to redress that balance that Chris is discussing there, the balance between tackling the pandemic on one hand and causing worse or other damage with the measures that you are applying to the virus. So the summer felt much more relaxed. There was an amount of willingness by the government for people to go out and socialise. In fact, here in the UK, the government literally sponsored people to go and eat in cafes and restaurants. Is the bill for that what we're starting to receive now? Did people back off too far when the weather was nice?
I think they got the wrong message. The message they got was, oh, we're across the finish line, let's celebrate. And you can understand that. They went through a very difficult time and they put in extraordinary efforts. They really worked together. There was a strong sense of solidarity and they felt great. You know, this is an achievement. Now, the problem was, and I, you know, we've all said it, but it hasn't come through strongly enough. What needed to happen then, and we at WHO even put out guidance saying, look, when you're coming out of your lockdown, you've got to do it stepwise and you've got to understand that you live differently after your lockdown. And that's the difficulty, that we're having to learn steps to this new dance and we don't even have the clear steps. We have to create those steps and do it well together so that we can live in a way that allows us to have an economic life, a social life, a less distressing life, and also our health system can get on with doing all the other things it's there for, dealing with all the other illnesses. So indeed, you don't have large numbers of people dying from other things because they simply couldn't get the healthcare that would normally be a given. So what was missed in the summer was the opportunity to really develop that way of living, adapt to that way of living to prevent this resurgence now. Let's hope that people have got the message now and we get through this winter living with COVID, learning this new dance and finding a way to live as well as we can and as safely as we can.
Just to follow that up, though, Margaret, in terms of messaging in particular, are you noticing any governments, whether they're national ones or regional ones, who successfully got to grips with certainly what strikes me as the key problem here is that people are just really bored with this?
I think I'd point you to East Asia, that many countries, now you've referred to Vietnam, but I can also think of Hong Kong, I can think of Korea, countries that have had quite a big outbreak and dealt with it and have had small spikes and dealt with it each time. And I think the difference there is all of them have had a significant infectious diseases outbreak already. Hong Kong saw SARS, the first SARS. Vietnam also saw SARS. We lost one of our epidemiologists investigating that SARS in Vietnam. But Korea had MERS in 2015, and they had a very bad outbreak, and they had to learn a lot of pretty tough lessons during that time. These are societies that know what an infectious disease outbreak can do to you. I would also point to Africa. People have been like, how come Africa's doing so much better? And in many ways, it's because, again, the people of Africa know what an infectious disease outbreak can do to you and take it a lot more seriously.
Chris, did we here in Europe learn anything at all from the Sweden experiment? Sweden was something of an outlier in terms of its response. It didn't just wave the thing off and declare business as usual, but it didn't lock down as hard or as fast as, well, basically all of its neighbours did, certainly at the start of the pandemic. They certainly seemed to pay for that initially with a much higher death toll and much higher infection rates, certainly compared to their neighbours. But was there any kind of useful path cleared there?
Anders Tegnell, who is the lead for the public health implementation of their strategy in Sweden, has acknowledged that their strategy is not perfect. And one of the things they acknowledge is that in the same way in the UK, the failure to protect care homes was the big mistake. And the reason it was a big mistake is that it meant that the virus gets into that environment and spreads like wildfire. And you've got a whole cohort of very vulnerable people who are absolutely dependent on carers. So carers bring the virus in, or visitors, and then the people who are care home residents who catch it then pass it on to each other. Or, as was also the case, hospitals were cleared in a hurry to make space for the anticipated huge surge of coronavirus cases that we thought was coming, which didn't materialise, actually. And many of that space and capacity was created in healthcare services by sending people from the hospital who had coronavirus but weren't necessarily picked up into care homes where they stimulated these enormous outbreaks. Now, had that not happened, and it happened in Sweden, it happened in the UK, the death toll would have been very, very different. Now, it's very easy to be extremely wise in retrospect, and one must be very cautious of using what we dub in medicine as our retrospectoscope, where we look very pleased with ourselves and wise by benefit of hindsight effect. But at the same time, yes, Sweden have taken a different, interesting approach. They have been more relaxed about some aspects of what they've done. Their economy has taken less of a hit so far than, say, the UK economy has. But as Maggie de Blok, who is the Belgian health minister, has said, no one across Europe counts COVID the same way. And what she's getting at is one must be very careful about making comparisons between countries, for instance, across Europe, not just in terms of COVID rates, but in anything. Because if you look at the population of Sweden, it's measured in single numbers of millions. In fact, you could get the entire population of Sweden on the London Underground and move them around in an entire day, which is what the London Underground would normally be doing at peak. And that's just one country's population in just one city's public transport system. The population density in Sweden is very different than the population density of the UK. The number of people who are living in single occupancy housing in Sweden is very different than the number of people who are living in single occupancy housing in the UK, in the wrong direction for us in the UK. And as a result, there are many, many differences between these different geographies and these different jurisdictions. And therefore, what works in one place may well work in another, but it may well not. And you've got to be very careful before saying that works there, let's just apply it.
Margaret, this has, of course, been a massive challenge in public health messaging. But in this particular case, it's a particularly difficult one when it comes to messaging young people, who I think are probably the cohort least susceptible to official messaging. They are certainly, at least so far, among the cohorts least susceptible to COVID-19. And they're the ones who most want to go out and do all the stuff that you're really not supposed to be doing. How do you get this message about the new way of living across to them?
You're quite right. One of the really tricky things about this particular virus is who it affects most severely. So everybody gets infected, but some people get a great deal more ill than others. Getting that message across that it may not be a problem for you, but it will be a big problem for others was difficult. Also, the message like, have a terrible life, stay indoors all the time, don't have any fun because you might infect someone else. That's quite a tough one. Having said that, young people, old people, most people have a core of decency and are willing to help if it's made clear how they can help. It would have been more effective if we'd found ways to enable young people to have a decent social life without being shut down in lockdowns, or to ask them, okay, how can we do this? How can we live more safely but enjoyably? What can you do? So we haven't seen enough of that bottom-up communication, that what do you think we should be doing better?
Chris, we are coming to the part of the program in which I ask you the question, which you will be aware I have asked you many times before in tones of increasing agitation. And this is the question which hopefully leads us to the answer of when we might never have to speak of this thing again. And that question is, how are you and your fellow virologists and epidemiologists and associated boffins doing in the hunt for a vaccine?
Well, I've been talking to quite a lot of people across the industry about this now, and everyone is centering on there will be a vaccine. People are optimistic in that respect. They think we're going to get one. They think that actually we're going to see results from phase three trials for many of the vaccine candidates that have made it that far pretty soon. We were anticipating them this October. There's still a week or so left of October, so let's see if they turn up. And in the meantime, when is that going to reach the general population? The argument goes it's something like next year, because of all the checks and balances that have to be done in order to make sure a vaccine is considered safe. Certainly in the UK, we're not looking at anything going at scale until probably June or July next year. That said, in China, you can go and buy on the street a vaccine, but it's not one that Margaret's organisation would say she would approve of, I wouldn't have thought, because there are certain important regulatory and important trial considerations that have been bypassed with that vaccine and others, including one made in Russia. So therefore, there's not a risk-free situation going on here.
Margaret, all that being said, and that does sound cautiously optimistic, but is there still a case for suggesting that we have to figure out how to live as if there isn't going to be a vaccine?
Absolutely. And I do agree with Chris, and I agree with the timeline that he mentioned on the vaccine, that we are optimistic that there will be a good candidate, but we as WHO will not back any candidate until it's proven very safe and it's got a good level of efficacy. Because if you roll out something that only protects, say, 2 in 10 people, all those 10 people think they're protected. In fact, only 2 of them are. Then you've got people sort of believing that everything's fixed and you've actually made it worse. But indeed, we will need to live for a very long time, and we're talking years, in the post-COVID era or the new COVID era. We will need to take precautions and be safe, because even if we get that great candidate vaccine, we need to roll that out to the highest risk groups, and that's the frontline workers, the health workers, and people with underlying conditions. And we need to do that around the world. That will be the first 1 billion doses. After that, it will go down to the next groups in priority. So for the average person, you're really not looking at having access to that vaccine for a couple of years. But we want to also bring down transmission as much as possible. So we all must learn to live. You will learn this new COVID dance, learn to live the safer way, look at how we can work remotely more often, we can be less crowded, not use public transport in the highly crowded ways we do. We have really urbanized our entire population. We need to think very seriously about living differently, because we are going to have more of these new emergences. We are seeing an increasing number of new emergences, and I'm sure Chris can speak to that form more effectively than I can. But pandemic preparedness experts made this point in a report that was released a month or so ago, when they said we have got to stop these cycles of panic then neglect. You know, with panic, we do all this stuff and then we forget about it. We have to get a bit more serious.
Chris, I will put a variation of that thought of Margaret's to you just in closing then. The theme of this episode basically is, what have we learned from attempting to deal with COVID-19? If we're trying to grasp for some further optimism here, is it at least possible, because this won't be the last pandemic, that we will be better equipped to deal with the next one?
Now, lightning struck twice with Wuhan, because we've seen all this before. I gave a lecture in 2007 to the students at Cambridge University talking about where SARS happened, how it happened, what the mechanisms were, and then predicted that this could easily happen again, and that the world was cruising for a biological bruising, as I put it, because we've created this perfect sort of global incubator for something to crop up somewhere and then be very rapidly disseminated around the world. So I hope the learning point from this will be that, A, why has this happened? It's happened because the world population is going up and up and up. And the world population is what is driving this, because it's leading to encroachment of human activity and human living spaces into nature and bringing us into close contact with the natural world where there are viruses that can, if given the chance to, jump the species barrier. We've also created the perfect incubator by living in the population density that we're living in, and we've created the perfect population dissemination mechanism with our travel network. And we need to be thinking about all these factors and working out how to anticipate this is going to happen again, and were it to happen again, what barriers could we put in the way in all of those things in order to make sure that we don't see the sorts of impacts that we're seeing this time. Because it's certainly true it will come again. It's not if, it's when. But we've been saying that for years. It is important that people do learn this time, and we have more resilience built into the system.
Chris Smith and Margaret Harris, thank you both for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolin Goffan and edited by Jack Jewers. From me, Andrew Miller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.